Please go ahead.
Okay. Gisela, do you want to...
With pleasure. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. On today's PPSC PDP call on Thursday, the 16th of September, we have Jeff Newman, James Bladel, Tatiana Kramsova, Wolf Ulrich Norben, Paul Diaz. From staff, we have Marika Konings, Glenda Saint-Géry, Margie Milam, myself, Gisela Gruber-White. We have apologies from Avery Doria and Alex Gakuru. Alan Greenberg should be joining us shortly. And if I can please just remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Jeff.
Good morning and good afternoon. This is Jeff Newman, the chair of the PDP work team. So there's a couple things that before we actually dive into the continuing to work on the the chart and reviewing the public comments, I just wanted to first, we have now been, as all working groups have been given guidance, we are now required to talk about and implement a new requirement for disclosures of interest. And I think a number of you are probably members of other working groups and have probably done this already in those other working groups. So I'm just going to read to you what I was sent, and then Marika and others can answer any questions. But essentially, this new requirement is really to disclose, is to do a written statement to disclose any direct or indirect interest that may be commercial, just, you know, monetary or payment, or non-commercial, which would be a non-tangible benefit such as publicity, political, or academic visibility, and that may be, that may affect or be perceived to affect your judgment on a specific issue. And to simplify matters, essentially what this is going to be is really just an update to the statement of interest that's already that we already have posted, that we did, gosh, I guess for this group over well over a year ago. So it's really just a an update to that, and then at every meeting we'll start the agenda with asking if there are any updates to that that disclosure of interest. At some point there's going to be an online form for this, but I think that's down the road, and you know, I don't think that's going to be available to us. Does anybody have any questions? Okay, so Marika, I guess technically we probably should give people time, obviously, to file that statement. So if we give people 2 weeks to file to get that on record, is that, will that be sufficient for the ICANN rules?
This is Marika. I think so. I think normally people are supposed to indicate on the call whether they have one, and then they can file it afterwards, I think, in writing. But Glenn, is that correct?
That's right. Yes, Marika.
Okay, so I guess I'll start on this call, and pretty self-evident, and I think this is in my statement of interest anyway. Obviously, you know, I'm an employee of Neustar, and Neustar is a contracted party. If there's a change to the policy development process, that would be a change to the way our contracts in theory could be amended, and therefore, I guess there's an interest there. So I'm disclosing that. And why don't we go around to the other members that are on the call, and if they want to throw in a statement, then they can. Actually, I'm sorry. I see James and Alan and Wolf, so if I can go to James.
Well, I think this builds on what Marika was saying and the question that Paul raised in chat. If we don't have anything beyond what was put in our original statement of interest, is it necessary to file anything at all?
This is Marika. If there's no difference, if all the information is there, there's no need to file anything else. That's my understanding.
Okay. Thank you. I don't have anything to add beyond my original statement of interest, which is very similar to Jeff's. We're a contracted party. Changes to policy affect our business and could increase liability exposure for us, and we're very aware of that as we participate in this process to manage that that uncertainty.
Okay. Alan?
Yeah, I wasn't involved in the group that created this. My understanding was a little bit different in that the disclosure of interest was required to explicitly identify the overlaps in this particular work group. So my understanding is the disclosure is required if there is any. My question was a little different. Is one required if the answers are no to everything? And that different groups are implementing that differently.
It's up to the individual working group? Is that?
I don't know if it's up to the individual working group, but some are only requiring it if there is interest to disclose, and some are saying we want it from everyone. With perfunctory no answers to them.
Jeff, it's Wolf speaking. May I?
Sure, absolutely, yes.
Well, I'm a member of that group, which produced, the new rules of procedure. And actually yesterday we had a discussion in the working team about the disclosure of interest and the SOI as well. So we have, just to make it clear, so we will have in future two kind of statements or disclosure. One is a statement, or as it used to be in the past as well, and the other one should be the disclosure of interest, which is a slightly different from what Alan was saying. The disclosure of interest is related to actual topics which are on the actual agenda of each working team. If there is somebody who has a kind of conflict of interest or so in that regard, so he or she should disclose that. And the question which was raised and which is still open, whether it should be made in written form or not, and there is a tendency to do it not in a written form, just to that the chairman of each working team is going to ask anybody in the team whether he has something to disclose with regards to the actual agenda items, and if there is nothing, then it is vetted. That's with regard to the DOI, and the statement of interest, where we have, I think, forms also available. There's only the question whether there are amendments in between and updates, and that's it. It should be handled as easy as possible.
Okay, thanks, Wolf. And I think the agenda for us for the next several weeks is going to be pretty similar or pretty much the same. Going over the public comments to the PDP and probably would be the same issues week after week. Okay, so is there anybody else that has anything to add? Paul, did you want to just...
Jeff. Sure. Paul Diaz from Network Solutions. I'll reiterate, paraphrase what Jeff and James both said, in that I represent a contracted party, therefore my interest in this directly pertains to any sort of dramatic changes, level of effort changes, et cetera, that would impact our business. But all of that was stated in the statement of interest, and there's no real change.
Okay. Actually, Wolf, you had a question. You had just had a comment, but is there anything you want to disclose to us at this point in time?
Yes. Let me complete that. Well, I'm employed by Deutsche Telekom, telecom communication provider, and this company is also running a registrar company, like it's called T-Online, and so we have some interest in that regard, but we have, there is no intention right now to participate in the present new GTLD process, not yet. That was disclosed in written form as well.
Okay, thank you, Wolf. Alan, you had a comment, but I don't believe you disclosed anything and may not, but I just want to give you the opportunity.
To answer, same as I did for another one, I have intellectual interests only.
Oh, that's a sad intellectual. No, never mind.
Which translates to mean I don't stand to make any money out of this at all, unfortunately.
So let me go to the ICANN participants. Are there anything that you, ICANN staff, anything you wish to disclose?
This is Marika. I think actually we're, as ICANN staff, we're not considered participants as such of a working group. I don't think we, well, I think that discussion is still ongoing as well in the working group, so I think for now we're not required to, we don't file statements of interest either, and we already have, I think, there are certain forms that we sign as employees from ICANN that, you know, address those kind of issues. But I think that's an issue that's also under the discussion. But I had my hand actually raised as well to ask a question to Wolf, because I think it would be really helpful if the work team that's dealing with the DOI, if they could provide some concrete examples, especially for those that apply to working groups, because in a council context, I think it's quite clear as they deal with very different topics that members indeed are required to make, you know, maybe at every meeting a disclosure of interest because there are new topics on the agenda. But in working groups, I think, you know, many feel that because they already provide a statement of interest that normally relates to the issues that a certain working group discusses, that it's not very clear what kind of things are expected. So if there are any kind of examples, you know, the work team could provide that might help in, you know, making the process smoother and getting a better understanding of what is required. Because, for example, in these, you know, normally in these meetings, as we're, you know, we're now going to run a couple of meetings probably going through public comments, there's no formal agenda. So, you know, I don't know how to deal with that. If you say, like, they only need to declare on issues that are on the agenda, what if we don't have an agenda? What does it mean that there's no need for disclosure of interest, or, you know, how does that work?
Okay, if I may, Wolf speaking.
Yeah.
Just a quick answer. So, okay, it's an ongoing process. So, and we learned as well in the team. Also, the rules of procedure have been already to some extent accepted by the council. So we have some open points still, and these are the open points. And we are really so thinking about, and so we will have a weekly call to find solution from that. So at every call we come up with new types of examples, and so it's not that easy to combine it, all of that. But I'm sure that we find a solution, and we find also guidance for that for the working teams. That our goal is, well, really, as I said, that the working teams and working groups should be able to handle that in a very easy form, in an easy way, not to be confused. Last time at the last council meeting, the councillors themselves have been confused, well, how to deal with that, and Chuck was also not very clear about that. So we have tasks to do.
Okay. I'd like to actually try to move on, I guess, a little bit. And I suppose, Marika, ICANN's statement of interest or disclosure of interest could be any changes to the PDP could materially increase or decrease the amount of workload for policy development staff.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Okay, with that kind of underway, we'll ask for updates at every meeting, and for people that do, they will follow up in writing. So I just want to say I'm actually only on this call for another 15 minutes or so, and then I'm going to ask Marika to continue on. I have a previous commitment that I will just say was made for me without my knowledge until late last night, so I have to jump off. But that said, I want to remind everyone that next week, the 23rd, if I've got the date right, the week from today, and I don't know if someone could help me with the UTC time, but for the East Coast U.S. time, we're extending the meeting to a three-hour meeting, and it's going to start a half hour earlier and end an hour later. And I know there were some people that submitted apologies already that they couldn't do the full session, but I think hopefully we can get some additional work done, and that time seemed to work out for most of the people. So I just want to remind everyone about that for next week. Any questions?
This is Marika. Just to know that it would start at 1300 UTC and then run to 1600 UTC.
Great. Thank you.
And just to confirm, I think Paul already indicated that he couldn't make that meeting, and Wolf sent a message saying that he would be joining late. So the question is basically, does it mean that everyone else can make that time?
Yeah, so if anyone now knows that they cannot make it, I mean, if you could just let us know either now or let us know on email. Obviously, the meeting won't be very effective if we don't have people there. So, you know, we missed last week because there was a last-minute change in schedule, and there were a lot of people that actually had responded before that saying they couldn't be there. And with the amount of people that said they couldn't be there, it just didn't seemed like we could hold a call last week. So let's and I see James now filed something. So let's see who can actually attend. But the plan is to go for a full 3 hours. And if it's just myself and Marika, we'll just, you know, we'll just write the whole thing. I'm kidding about that. So hopefully people can show up. With that said, I want to go back to where we left off. And then Marika will help get the discussion going when I'm not, when I have to drop off in 10 minutes, which is on the specific. So we started off on this public disclaimer, just to remind people, this is the chart that was done by ICANN policy staff, Marika, to summarize the comments that came in and group them with the issues or the recommendations that we had in the report. And then who submitted a comment, and then whether we have a response to it, and if so, and the response could be, yeah, we considered it, and you know, we decided not to do that for these reasons, or we didn't consider it, and here's what we think. So, you know, there's no prearranged outcome, but in order to comply with, you know, ICANN policy development and with the AOC and others, we do need to make sure we've considered all the comments that we've received, and I think we've gotten some really good comments in. Marika, let me ask the question. Did we get, and I know we closed the comment period, but or we are closing it. Have we gotten anything new?
Your knowledge? This is Marika. I actually need to check. I didn't check it recently. There was one other comment that I think I did integrate already here. It was a relatively short comment. I'm just scrolling down to see whether I did or not. Yeah, that's comment on 38, basically on recommendation 38, so it will come up later in the discussion. So there was one comment filed past the last meeting, and I'll have a look now if anything else has been filed in the meantime. But last time I checked, that wasn't.
Okay. Great. Yeah, if you could just follow up with that and make sure, because I think we officially said we were going to close it at the end of September. I think
we're going to. I'm just checking. The only thing we got is a spam message.
Okay. So the issues that we started on or have been discussing in the last couple of weeks have been more general in nature. They didn't really map to specific recommendations, and so that's what we started on. Now we are on specific recommendations, comments to specific recommendations, and so we can hopefully not spend too much time on these, because I think a lot of these we actually did talk about, and so we can indicate that. So the first comment, which is up on the screen now, relates to recommendation one, which is who can request an issues report, and INTA has asked that, or said that the PDP ought to address the manner in which unaffiliated groups and individuals can properly raise issues they would like to be considered. For example, is there a funneling mechanism that could be created which would vet or pass this information to a GNSO or relevant constituency? If you recall, in the recommendation, it was that the existing mechanisms to raise an issue were to be maintained, which is, you know, through the GNSO, or the advisory committees, or the board. And we did, I do remember we discussed this issue, and I think the outcome, and I actually explicitly remember this, the outcome was that if the issue was, since we were talking about issues, a PDP is for the GNSO, if there was an issue that couldn't be raised through one of those existing mechanisms, then it may not be worth addressing. In other words, it was maybe that's not the right way to say it. I think the way it came out was that if the issue was important enough to one of the constituencies or the advisory committee, then it was that group's job to convince someone, because it's really not that big of a burden to raise an issue, but it was really to convince someone within the system to raise that issue. Now, that's different than can we put on the website information on who the constituencies are, you know, what in general is a short description of who they serve, and let them decide, you know, who to go to. But I'm not. But that's not really the question. The question is there any other funneling mechanisms? And the way we came out in those previous discussions was that we thought the existing mechanisms were enough, and that if the issue were important enough to address, that those groups should be able to convince one of the stakeholder groups, constituencies, advisory committees, or the board that this was important to address. Does anybody have any changes from that opinion? People have comments. Did I not state that correctly or have other memories of it? Okay, so I'm hearing silence. So I think, Marika, if we could just indicate that in the chart.
No, I, Jeff, it's Alan. I did put my hand up. I guess I'll go a little bit further than what you said, which is an accurate repeat of the decision we came to at the time. That is, the converse, if you cannot convince anyone that this has any merit, I don't see how it's going to get very far within the organization anyway. I mean, even if a random individual can put in an anonymous request for an issues report and it gets honored, if there's no level of support, it's just going to die. So I don't think there's a lot of point in adding that process, which just adds work without any reasonable sanity checks in it.
Yeah, I think we did discuss that, and that's much more direct than my answer. But yes,
I'm not sure my words should be are the ones to be put in the answer. But essentially, that's what it comes down to. It's a make work effort if there's nobody in the whole organization who thinks it's important or important enough to ultimately. Because remember, when you're requesting an issues report, you're also implicitly making the comment that there are people who are going to work on it.
Yes, and I think, so other than basically making sure there's information on the website or in this guidebook that we develop on who the stakeholder groups and constituencies and advisory committees board, you know, description of who they are and what their interests are, and maybe trying to push people along to one of those groups that maybe most closely would align themselves with those types of interests, I'm not sure what else we can do for all of those reasons.
Yeah, I mean, there's an infinite number of things we could have issues reports and PDPs on that we all make. We're making value judgments along the way of which ones we don't even bother requesting at any given point, and I think we need that balance. Otherwise, the workload, which is already reasonably high, would just become nonsensical.
Yep. Okay. If we want to move on to the next one, and then I'm going to just leave this with Marika. Marika, I think we don't have control over the bottom part of the screen. We have control over scrolling through the report, but not the bottom.
Ms. Marika, you should have control now. Sorry for that.
Cool. Okay. So recommendation number three, and I'm going to drop off. There were two comments on recommendation number three. Recommendation number three is fairly short. It's that there is a development of a manual or guidebook, a policy development process manual or guidebook, which will constitute an integral part of the rules of procedure intended to provide guidance and suggestions to the GNSO and ICANN communities on the overall PDP process, including those steps that could assist the community, working group members, counselors, in gathering evidence and providing sufficient information to facilitate the overall policy development process. The two comments we got were that there's support for recommendation number three from the INTA, and that would like the manual open for public comment as it's developed. And the other comments from the registries was that just a question more of how that guidebook is going to be developed. There's a note that this recommendation appears to be a duplication, or recommendation five appears to be a duplication of this one. And I think that's right, but it was raised in a different context. So I think when one just reads the recommendations kind of in a vacuum, it looks identical, but when you look at the discussion, I think it came up out of different circumstances. So that's kind of why they're duplicated. Going back to the first question, which seems pretty easy to respond to, is that they would like the manual to be open for public comment as developed. I think that's the intention, as with all of the rules of procedure, I believe, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but all of those are open for public comment. And so if that requires a statement by us, I think that would be a beneficial one to make explicit. But, Alan, and then, Marika, if you could just take over. I have to log off my computer, but I'll be able to listen for the next 5-10 minutes.
Yeah, in terms of being open for public comment during development, with a lowercase p and c, yes. I don't think these things are necessarily going to be open for public comment in the formal sense, in the capitalized sense within ICANN. I mean, I can't imagine the process that we have an open comment on pointing to some documents that are being discussed and being written and rewritten as we speak.
I would think that, in essence, if you establish an open mailing list to develop this, so if there's a group that's working on it, or if we work on it, we all do have open mailing lists, and drafts are put on the public wiki. And
that's what I'm saying. Public comment in lowercase sense, but not the formal defined sense within ICANN.
Right, but I do think, so there's two things. So it's open during, the mailing list would be open, and documents posted on the web. And I think, I know the GNSO Council, or if I'm just hallucinating, and you could correct me, but I believe the GNSO Council does, when they come up with the rules or proposed rules, they do put that out for a formal, capital P, capital C, public comment period.
Yes, certainly. I was commenting on the during development process part.
Ah, gotcha. So if we could just then clarify that, the way we were thinking about it was that, when it's being developed, that it would be developed through the standard process where mailing lists and documents would be open to the public, and that it would certainly be the expectation to have a public comment period once or after those are developed, so that people can review those as well. And I'm no longer online, so I don't know if there are comments. Marika, then, can you take over?
Yeah, this is Marika. I actually had my hand raised as well, because I think from, how I had looked at, indeed, the discussion of developing the manual or rules of procedure or whatever it's going to be called would be, indeed, because once this group comes up with a more firm, structure for the PDP, we might already be able to start in filling some of those parts. Because I think once we have a clear idea of which parts, our bylaw changes and which elements might go into the rules of procedure, I think we start having already some building blocks. And then, of course, that needs to be all knitted together. And I think we've spoken in several instances as well about providing examples or suggestions on what a PDP working group could explore as part of the process. So I think, the idea I would have, indeed, once this working group has come to firm recommendation of how the PDP could look. I mean, for example, staff could take as a task to develop a first draft of those rules of procedure, which then could be reviewed by this work team or by the PPSC or a separate team that depends on how, you know, how the group would prefer to do that. And indeed, that will be put out like the genus or working group guidelines have been done as well through, you know, one or two rounds of public comments depending on you know, feedback received and changes that need to be made. And I think, again, you know, they probably will pass through several rounds of public comments, as I think with all the other documents that have been recently adopted by the Genius Oak Council, they pass through work team public comment periods, then maybe OSC public comments, and then as well council public comments. So I think in that sense, there should be, you know, plenty of opportunity to provide input and guidance. And again, I think as Anand, I think Anand mentioned as well, of course, you know, at some point, I guess those kind of documents are never final, because I guess down the road there should be a process in place as well that would look at the long-term review and, you know, if any elements need to be changed or added. So that there should be a process as well that takes that into account when future changes are made and then how public comments are incorporated in that regard. So are there any other comments or questions on this issue? I mean, maybe the question I had just explained, I think, from staff's perspective, you know, how we would propose maybe to develop this by providing a first draft that could be further fleshed out. Is it something that, because the question by the registry stakeholder group is indeed how are the contents going to be developed? Is it something that members of the work team agree with that approach, or do you believe that a work team should be dedicated to writing up such a manual themselves, or what do people feel would be the best approach to get that document together? Anyone still on the call?
I guess it's our job to at least initiate the process, whether it's this group that does it or we try to Shanghai somebody else into working on it. I hate to add infinitely to our work, and this isn't the only thing that's mentioned in the document as something we have to do in the future. But I think the onus is on us to initiate the process or give notice to the council it needs to be done or something.
James?
Hi, Marika, and apologies to the rest of the group. I've kind of been multitasking during this segment, and I think it was quite a while ago that we actually drafted these recommendations. So some of them, I'm sure we discussed them for, you know, quite lengthy discussions on these, but it was so long ago they actually look new again. So my question is there any concern that anything that we would put in the form of a manual, I mean, if it goes beyond just a frequently asked questions or a guidebook or a pamphlet, if we start to put any more meat on it than that, doesn't it start to run the risk of creating differences of interpretation between that and various bylaws and other types of more formal documents? Yes, that would be my concern with going too far with this idea of a policy development manual.
Well, this is Marika. I think, you know, maybe indeed we should definitely reflect on the term or update the term, because I think the way we've been talking about it more recently is indeed that you would have the bylaws and then you would have the rules of procedure, where the rules of procedure then provide more details, examples, you know, flesh out some of the elements that are in the bylaws, but not have certain elements in the bylaws, not to make it too strict or, you know, provide more flexibility. So I think what we're actually talking about, and of course those rules of procedure, I think we're, you know, indicating already in several areas, you know, what that should contain or what information should be in there. So I think they, you know, should map very closely, and then absolutely right, they, you know, there shouldn't be other things in there that don't track back to the recommendation that this group provides and you know, the elements that are contained in the bylaws. So that should form a complete package. So maybe I think the term manual guidebook might be misleading, and I think we're actually talking about rules of procedure.
Yeah, and I can appreciate that, but, you know, having maybe a little bit more ICANN experience under my belt than I did when we originally wrote this, I've seen, you know, very drawn-out debates and discussions over something as simple as verb confusion in the bylaws or something like that. So I think that, you know, it's just something that any time you have two documents, you get into questions of which one governs that particular scenario, which one isn't scope. So I'm okay with that. I just wanted to point out that we run the risk of more information we put into a guidebook, the more possibility or likelihood we will introduce confusion down the road. That's all.
Thanks. Alan?
Yeah, the way the recommendation is worded, saying there will be a manual or guidebook as part of the rules of procedure, I find that a little bit confusing. If it is a set of examples and or scenarios, then that makes some sense. I wouldn't want a manual which implies a list of instructions as a separate thing outside of the actual rules, you know, but appended to it. But as someone who came into this process and tried to figure out how does one initiate a PDP before, you know, where we had to go back to the bylaws and it ended up going to, you know, ICANN legal counsel to tell us what these words meant because they were conflicting with each other, we wanted a little bit easier than that. And so there should be some sort of way to find out what the process is without having a lawyer by your side. But I don't think it should be prescriptive. I think we need examples and that kind of stuff over and above whatever is formally in the rules procedure.
And this is Marika. I put myself in the queue as well because to give you, for example, the example of the Juniso Working Group guidelines, those are as well guidelines, and the idea of those is that they will be indeed an appendix to the Juniso Rules of Procedure. And I think the way the PPSC envisioned that, that it would be easy for working groups to abstract that document from the Rules of Procedure while still they're being part of it and therefore an integral part of the overall Rules of Procedure. And, you know, maybe the work team could think about it in a similar way, that indeed it is part of the Rules of Procedure, but to facilitate, you know, taking that out and, you know, giving that to a working group, indeed of having it integrated with different paragraphs and sections and in an overall document, it might be easier as an annex, but still having that, you know, the level of the status that Rules of Procedure have. And then, indeed, maybe the question is, indeed, if people feel that, you know, examples and further details might be, you know, a separate, the need for a separate document, and, you know, that's something that can be explored. But, you know, my proposal would be to, because I think, you know, we're internally already trying to work on a first draft of, you know, what would be part of a new Annex A based on the recommendations that the work team has currently developed. In addition, as part of that discussion, of course, there's some elements as well that obviously would need to go to the rules of procedure. So, you know, maybe the best way of going about it is to have a look at what we come up with at the end of the day and see whether indeed there's need for more detail maybe in that document or whether there would be a need for a separate document that just might provide some examples that might help working groups to conduct their deliberations. Wolf, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Well, since it's several months ago that we talked about that, so I'm not so clear what we really have decided and what is the content we have already produced. But what I would like to say is, so at first it must be clear, you know, the reason why we. Why we wanted to come up with the question of producing a manual or guidebook, the necessity about that. Is it, for example, just give more details around this chart, you know, the PDP flow chart to be produced? Is it something more which describes, you know, this process with regards to the PDP flow chart, or is it something more in detail? So that's what we have to find out at first, you know, and that's what I understand is also behind that question. And then whether it is put then as an appendix to the rules or as a separate rule or in on the level of bylaws or whatever, I think that that's the question which could be solved later on as well. The for me is a question whether we need it and what should be the content of it. So, and that's not that clear at the moment for me.
And then this is Marika. I think that probably will become more clear once, you know, we have the skeleton of the new Annex A where people can see what, you know, based on the discussions we've had, you know, will be in the bylaws. And I think from there it will hopefully naturally flow what kind of information needs to be contained in the rules of procedure. I think we've spoken about things like, for example, you know, the content of an issues report. You know, at the moment it's spelled out in the bylaws, but is it really necessary to be spelled out there? It's maybe more appropriate for the rules of procedure. And I think if you look at some of the other, you know, rules of procedure that have been recently adopted, for example, if you look at the absentee voting, I think it's probably mentioned in the bylaws, they say there can be absentee voting. And then the rules of procedure actually flesh out how that in detail works. And I think you're part of the underlying thought about that as well, that the, changing the bylaws is much harder and, you know, requires more work than changing the rules of procedure. So, you know, of course, you do go through a different stage of public comment and discussion and before you put it in rules of procedures, but if at a certain point in time, you know, there's a feeling that certain parts need to be changed, there is an easier way to adapt those than it is for the bylaws. But as I said, I think, you know, we probably need to review that in further detail once we have the skeleton, and hopefully from there we'll flow naturally what kind of information needs to be in the rules of procedure and what information should be in the bylaws.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are no further comments, we can maybe move on to recommendation four comments. Recommendation four deals with how the issues report should be requested. And seeing here we have a number of comments in relation to that, so maybe we just take them one by the one. I think they're made by INTA and by the registry stakeholder group and the registrar stakeholder group, and I've tried to separate them out in the different issue you know, to facilitate our review. So the first one there is from INTA, basically saying some basic template details should probably be mandatory, including, for instance, a statement as to why the issue is important to the relevant constituency. And to note there, in our initial on the working recommendation, I think we said there a template would be helpful, but I think, if I recall well, a discussion, I think people preferred that it would be optional and not mandatory. And that's what we said as well. Further consideration would need to be given as to whether some of these elements should be required before a request is considered by the GMSO Council. Alan, please go ahead.
Yeah, we definitely did say the template should be optional, and I would still support that. I'm a little bit confused about the second half of the statement because I thought that the original definition of an issues report includes the requirement to say why you think it's important to you. Is that not currently part of the in the current PDP rules, one of the required parts of an issues report request?
This is Marika. I think there are no. I'm not sure, actually. I need to check. I thought there was no requirement or no details as to what such a request would need to look like, but I'm quickly checking.
Because my recollection is it's part of the issues report. It is defined as a required part of the issues report, and therefore I would have thought obvious that whoever is asking for it should say why, you know, should give the word to staff.
I've just checked the bylaws, and it actually doesn't specify. It just indicates who can raise an issue.
No, I understand, but isn't it a part of the, isn't it a required section of an issues report?
Yes, the issues report does require how that party is affected by the issue, the party raising it. But, again, it's no requirement for the party requesting the issues report to say that. So that might be a staff interpretation in that regard. So.
All right. So as part of the template or the suggestion can say if you don't want staff to have to make up a reason for you, maybe you should give your own. But okay. I knew it was required somewhere, so it's in the issues report. not in the request, although anyone making a request, I would think, would include that to give some rationale for why it's, you know, to make sure staff is interpreting it right. But okay.
So I guess one of the further discussions the working will need to have, indeed, is what its recommendation needs to be changed to make certain elements mandatory or not. I don't know if anyone has any views on that now or whether they want to leave that to later discussion.
I don't have a strong view. It's one of those things that one can suggest, but you can't. I wouldn't want to see a request for an issues report rejected by staff because there's no other process for it. Because it does not meet the correct format, that becomes a staff decision, and I don't think that would be appropriate. There's no one else approving the request for an issues report once the document is submitted to staff. And I don't think we want a staff interpretation rejecting something at that level. So my recommendation is we don't want mandatory things like that, which then give a level of discretion on staff interpreting whether a condition is met or not.
Does anyone else have any views on mandatory or non-mandatory?
Yeah. I mean, we are foreseeing an environment where there'll be more interaction between the requesting body and staff prior to the formal submission. So hopefully that will cover things like that that are missing, if they're really necessary.
Paul?
Yeah, thanks, Marika. I just wanted to support what Alan just said. I think that the group here in our proposals, we are clearly envisioning a future where, you know, the sort of what we've experienced in the past, PDPs that were put forward because one person feels very passionately about it but doesn't have a really well-formed idea of, you know, how to go about doing it or is there data support, et cetera. If that sort of thing will be in the past. I agree it should not be mandatory, but, you know, trying to get as much, be the best way, it's much detail, as much fact up front, and making that a strong recommendation to start off the process. I think that's where we were going, and jumping ahead to the registrar's comments, I think that's what we were thinking, that we just don't want to see this case where, you know, effectively a single counselor can push something through with a bare minimum of support, doesn't really have a full-fledged idea of how it's going to play itself out, and then we spend many, many months thereafter trying to figure out how to do it.
Yes, we look at the next comment also in relation to this issue also made by INTA is issues for consideration should be raised through an electronic online process that is linked to relevant sections of the PDP manual.
I guess I have to comment.
Go ahead.
I have filled out a number in the last 6 months or so, a number of ICANN processes, which are electronic online tools. And in all cases, one writes the document in Word, one refines it, one gets comments on it, and then you cut and paste into the electronic into the electronic tool. I think sometimes we get carried away with the electronic tools. So I would be careful on that.
And I guess your previous comments might apply here as well, that it might be an option, but it shouldn't be the required format, and if it's not submitted that way, it's rejected, I presume.
I would tend to say that, yes. I would strongly encourage that we work encourage interaction early in the process to make sure that the document, whatever is submitted in a usable way, but mandating in a formal rule that it must be an electronic process. Maybe I'm just too old and I'm not adapted to the new world of the internet, but I see it as more obfuscation than a real help.
If we then look at the next comment from the registrar stakeholder group, and Paul already touched upon that one, the registrar stakeholder group believes this is a responsible step toward making future policies based on evidence and facts, a template that includes a clearly defined problem, well-documented supporting evidence, and a rationale for the use of increasing very limited resources for development of policy would be a useful tool. I see no hands. If we move on to the next one, also from the registrar stakeholder group, any manual or guidebook should encourage that ICANN participants are mindful and respectful of ICANN's limited resources. Alan, go ahead.
Yeah, this is all true, but as I go through various working groups, ICANN's real problem there's a resource problem on the staff side. The resource problem on the volunteer side is we're not getting people engaged. And we're not giving the convincing argument to people to get engaged. I participate in a whole bunch of working groups, and it's amazing how often the same people over and over again are on these groups. And these people are getting burnt out, and these people are overstressed. There's no question about it. And these people are the same ones who volunteer for the next task. And I've just seen James's name on one of the review teams, so... we're gluttons for punishment, but our real resource problem is we're not getting enough people involved in it. And I don't know how we make that clear in this kind of document, but it's not only ICANN's limited resources, it's our inability to get new people involved in the processes. Maybe this document is not the place for a political speech, but I made it anyway.
Thank you. So the next comment is also from the registrar stakeholder group, basically stating that they look forward to a continued discussion of what should constitute a reasonable threshold for initiating a PDP. And I think, if I can just comment on that, I think that's an issue that we'll come back to on in the overarching issues, where I think one of the elements we're looking at is the voting threshold. So probably that will be discussed further in further detail in that context. And no further comments, I propose we move on to recommendation 6, which deals with the creation of the issues report. There's one comment here that was made at the meeting in Brussels, basically stating, should there be certain requirements for which elements an initial report should contain, example given, draft recommendations, conclusions. And I think that comes back as well to what we've seen with certain recent working groups where reports have been put out and have been called initial reports, even though they don't contain any draft recommendations. So part of the question there, of course, is I think the intention of most working groups that don't produce draft recommendations will put documents out in the next round of public comments, but the question here is, of course, like, you could get around that. You don't produce any recommendations in your initial report, you just call it an initial report and you go straight to a final report without any opportunity for the community to comment. So I guess the question is, should there be a requirement that if you call it an initial report, it should at least have draft recommendations or conclusions?
Well, are there scenarios where PDPs do not come out with recommendations?
This is Marika. Yes,
or is that a recommendation not to have a recommendation?
Yes. Right. I think that's how some working groups in the industry think, look, I don't think there have been any. There have always been some recommendations, even if it's not recommendations for changes to policy or new consensus policies. I think most, at least as long as I've been in, with ICANN, I think most working groups have produced some kind of recommendations. But, of course, in theory, indeed, I think the recommendation is no changes to policy or no new consensus policies or no further work needed as the recommendation.
So one can imagine a scenario where the recommendation is so cut and dry that no one believes there needs to be an interim report or an initial report. I mean, I think we can address the problem of a report that comes out that is not at the stage of where it has draft recommendations is call it something else. That's the that's an interim report, not the initial report. I really don't think we need to get hung up on it, but if the PDP mandates there must be an initial report, and we feel comfortable that all PDPs will end up with some recommendations, even if it's to say the status quo is fine, then there's no harm in requiring an issued report to float the recommendations out for public comment before they're cast in concrete. I think that's reasonable.
Margie?
Yeah, I think I'm saying the same things that Alan is saying, especially in light of the vertical integration issue. I think the issue is not so much whether you're making recommendations, because we don't necessarily have to make recommendations, but that the report, when you get to the point of an initial report, that it's essentially this, some stage of work has been concluded. In other words, if I think one of the frustrations I have with the vertical integration report is that it got published despite the fact that the group wasn't even done with its analysis and hadn't even reached consensus on anything. And with that being the initial report, the question is what happens when they come up with recommendations? You obviously don't want the next report to be a final report because you haven't had the ability to submit, post it for public comments and get feedback from the community. And that's one of the key elements, I think, of the process for transparency and accountability purposes, is to make sure that the report, when it gets published, to satisfy, the obligations under the bylaws, give some, realistic picture as to what the recommendations might look like so that the community who isn't in the working group can respond.
So, and this is Marika. I mean, well, one comment to the suggestion that Alan made. I mean, one other question, and that's maybe to be considered in a different context is, well, like, indeed, if a working group at a certain point realizes, like, this, we don't think a PDP is necessary and realize halfway through the process, in the current way it is, you just need to go through the motions and produce a final report, and that's the end of the PDP. But should there be a mechanism as well in which you can stop the PDP, just because maybe circumstances have changed, there might be other, external circumstances that mean that the issue is no longer there, or that it has, or there is indeed no way out, and it's very obvious from a certain part in the process that, there's no way forward. So, is it worth going through an initial report and going to a final report and doing public comments and meeting every week? So that's another thing the work team might want to consider. Should there be an exit if at some point at a certain, certain decision-making process where you say, okay, we see that this PDP is no longer relevant or it's not going anywhere, we just stop it here and don't require just to go, through the motions of this because, for going through the motions and nothing else. So that might be another issue to consider. So if you then look to the next comment on the same recommendation that was made by the registry stakeholder group, in some cases it might be useful to do additional research, hold discussions, or conduct outreach before an issues report is requested. So it might be useful to include this possibility in the manual guidebook. And I think, recalling from our discussions, I don't think we've indicated anywhere that shouldn't be a possibility. And I think it's actually something that the working would like to encourage as much as possible, that additional research and discussions are held before anything is produced.
It's Alan. I support the intent, but I don't see why it's one of our rules, why it needs to be one of our rules. There are various groups that can request an issues report. Each of them may have their own internal procedures that they may go through prior to requesting the issues report, and that could include years of study or could include, virtually nothing except writing the two-paragraph request for an issues report. I don't see how we can mandate what happens in those processes because it's not formally a step of the PDP process. It's something which may lead to the request for an issues report. So I'm not sure why we need to or even can set those rules.
This is Marika. I mean, I don't think we spoke in any. I mean, I think we had the discussion whether indeed, like, birds of a feather should be mandated before an issue is requested. But I think we all agree that, you know, it might not be appropriate. But I think I did have the feeling that most agree that it should be encouraged, that indeed additional discussions are held, or, you know, if appropriate research is carried out, or outreach on an issue. And I think that's something that we've stated on various parts, but yes, I don't think we ever spoke about mandating that. And actually realized that the previous comment relates to the initial report and probably should be moved to the relevant section and not the issues report.
Yeah.
Any other comments on this recommendation? If not, we move on to recommendation 7 in relation to the end result of a PDP. The registrar stakeholder group here states that they welcome this recommendation and issues should be met with a solution that most appropriately resolves them. I don't know if you need to say anything more on that apart from noted. I don't see any hands.
The corollary of that is come up with recommendations that don't address the problem. So. I guess I support it.
I'll know that. The next one is another comment that came from the meeting in Brussels. Although other outcomes are possible, the focus of a PDP should be foremost on the development of consensus policies relating to issues that are within the picket fence. And if I can just comment on that, I think it's something, you know, staff supports as well. And I think for that reason, you know, we suggested that in the flow chart, it's made very clear that there are other processes that can be explored for issues that don't require or are not expected to require consensus policy changes, so that indeed PDPs are not initiated for issues where it's upfront clear that it won't have any impact on consensus policies. Alan?
I think that goes directly against one of the first things we debated long and hard about whether PDPs are only for consensus policy or not. And I thought we came out with support from ICANN Legal Counsel and a number of other groups saying there are other things that are subject to consensus policy, to PDPs that are not consensus policy.
Right.
And outcomes of things that have consensus policy implications which might not be consensus policy. So I'm not quite sure one
right,
can accept this and accept the prior conclusions.
Right, but I think we did, you know, at least from our perspective, I think, you know, the other processes are, if it's really clear that a PDP is not required to achieve, you know, that kind of outcome, you might have a more flexible process and an easier way to get there. But Margie?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's not that we're saying that the council or the community shouldn't be looking at non-consensus policies. We're just saying that if you're going to do non-consensus policies, you know, there's less rigid, I guess, ways of achieving that, and we don't have to force everything through the timeline and the, you know, the bells and whistles that you find in the quote PDP process, because that's you know, that's really meant to provide the, you know, checks and balances for the contracted parties. So I think that, I mean, we're saying the same thing in that, you know, we're not going to say that the PDP rules don't apply to non-consensus policies. If the community feels that they want to go through that extra enhanced process, you can do it. But that's really the intent of the process is to focus on those issues that are within the picket fence. So I don't know if that helps clarify the
I guess it doesn't to me, because something that goes through a PDP has a force that the board cannot as easily ignore, as opposed to something that goes through any of the other processes. And therefore, although I'm not trying to say it should be the only mechanism to convince the board to do something, it does have a bylaw mandated strength that other processes don't. So I wouldn't want to see that diluted. Although I'll be the first to agree that the process is complex enough that one shouldn't use it unless there's a some rationale for needing it.
I don't see any further hands. We can move on to the next one, recommendation 10, in relation to the timeline for the issues report. That the registry stakeholder group comment states that maximum time frames in the current PDP in the bylaws have, for the most part, have had to be ignored because they were unrealistic for many issues. Time frames are better put into the manual guidebook instead of any bylaws. The practice of asking staff to provide estimates of time needed has worked fairly well in genital history and better accommodates the variability of issue complexity. Any comments? Or maybe should ask any disagreements?
No, it's a good comment, and we should make sure that what we end up doing follows that.
And this is Marika, actually, and why I'm here, because I've been looking at a comparison between the PDP for the CCNSO and the PDP of the GNSO, and actually the way it works there is that a timeline for the PDP or a tentative timeline for the PDP is part of the issues report and part of then the decision that the council takes on the basis of that proposed timeline. So it's a model, the works you might want to explore in further detail as an alternative for the current rigid bylaws that are being applied. If we then move on to recommendation 11, that is with community input, is a comment from INTA. INTA agrees with this position as it would allow relevant stakeholders and community members to have input on new issues that may not be reflected in the issues report.
I guess our only comment is thank you for agreeing with us.
So, put that notice. Could I move on to recommendation 12, the role of workshops, a comment by the registry stakeholder group. They ask the question, what is meant by a workshop? Workshops traditionally have been held at ICANN international meetings, but those are held only 3 times a year. Note that drafting teams have been used successfully in the GNSO in recent years for several purposes, including drafting charters, developing recommendations for consideration before initiating a PDP, etc. Does the work team see a place for drafting teams in the PDP process, and if so, what would that be? Anyone still awake apart from Alan?
Well, I won't answer this one then.
No, go ahead, Alan.
I'll step in if I'm the only one talking. Drafting teams tend to be set up when one needs to draft something. And I can see PDP working groups setting up drafting teams. We don't always call them that, but I'm not sure why we need to add a drafting team stage or requirement in the PDP process. Anyone is free to set them up when you need an ad hoc group to do something and pass it by other people. So I don't see the need to introduce the concept of drafting teams in our document. That doesn't mean they won't get used at some stage in the PDP process.
Anyone else? Well, go ahead.
Yes, well, by reading the recommendation itself, and so it came to my mind, I think it needs some clarification. So when I look back to what I have seen in ICANN happening with regards to developing, charters and first draft and these things, every time it comes up to the question, okay, to find people, well, to do that, and well, to and then to give them guidance as well, how to do that, or to give them guidance, okay, please give us guidance, well, to and draft some guidance. what we should do in the future. So the workshop is a little bit, it sounds a little bit too general. So I think that's behind the question is, the question is the role of the workshop and how it should be organized. So so I think it needs some more clarifications, or in that respect it could be seen as a kind of, it's general, what does he mean, workshop, who should participate? Then it comes up with the question, different interest groups are participating. How should it be organized? Is it a kind of drafting team or this thing? So I understand from Alan's point of view that it should be something which is in a pre-status, before drafting something. But then it's a question what. So if we could find find some more guidance, some more details with regards to this role, that it could be helpful.
Alan?
Yeah, I addressed the concept of drafting teams, which is the second half of the specific comment. The first part goes back to what we said, that we recommend the concept of workshops.
Mm.
But I'll also note I cannot think of a PDP that has been done in my history on council, and that goes back almost 4 years now, which didn't have one or typically more workshops that preceded the creation, the request for an issues report, and the PDP process that follows. It just always happens. Ideas rarely percolate up to the point where they get to the stage of issues report in a PDP without having typically a number of workshops. Even the infamous Fast Flux, there were a number of discussions that were held prior to it getting to that stage. And certainly on most of the others that if you think of domain tasting, there were many meetings about it. They just kept on being discussed. And so, although I think our recommendation and the support of it has merit, I don't think that's different from what has happened in the past. It's not a revolutionary suggestion.
Hmm.
As we have quite a number of comments on issue 13, and actually my phone is going to connect in 2.5 minutes, because my operator only gives me an hour and a half before it disconnects me automatically. The question is, I can hand over to Margie to continue, or we can wrap up early, as I believe some people might need to recover a bit and get the energy for the next meeting.
Yeah.
Is there a next meeting that I don't know about?
I'm sure there are next meetings. Well, we have a next meeting next week.
Sorry.
So I hope that people can come re-energized and with a lot of comments and
I support wrapping up early.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll try to capture then all the discussion we had today and send that around to the list. And then I think Gisa is going to send out another note on the mailing list to check who is going to be available for next week. I saw that Paul is not available, James not available. Wolf is joining late, so we need to verify that it's worth going ahead. Otherwise, just stick to the usual time. But we'll confirm that on the mailing list.
Okay.
So with that, thank you all.
Thank
very
you, Marika,
much for your participation.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Marika.
Thanks.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.